Imagine for a moment that you are building a house. You want the house to be strong, so you pour all the concrete into one corner. What happens? The house becomes dangerously unbalanced. It might even collapse. A wise builder spreads the weight evenly across the whole structure so that no single point bears too much pressure. Government works in a surprisingly similar way. When all the power of a government is held by one person or one group, the results throughout history have been dangerous. The challenge for anyone designing a government is not simply to make it powerful enough to do its job, but to make sure that power is spread carefully so it cannot be turned against the very people it is meant to serve. This lesson is about the answer that some of the greatest political thinkers in history developed to solve exactly that problem. It is called the separation of powers, and it is one of the most important ideas in the story of modern government. Let us begin with a question. Why would power corrupt a person in the first place? Think about someone you trust completely, perhaps a kind and fair teacher. Now imagine that teacher is given total control over the school. They can change the rules whenever they like. They can punish any student without any review of their decision. They decide how every penny of money is spent, and no one can question them. Even a genuinely good person in that situation might slowly begin to make decisions that serve themselves rather than the students. They might favor certain students. They might use the money for things they personally prefer. This is not because the teacher is evil. It is because power without limits removes the normal pressures that keep people accountable to others. Accountability means being responsible to others, having to explain your decisions and face consequences if those decisions are wrong or unfair. The political philosophers of the 1600s and 1700s, a period we call the Enlightenment, thought deeply about this problem. The Enlightenment was an era when thinkers across Europe began questioning old ideas about kings, religion, and authority. They wanted to build systems of government on reason rather than tradition. One of the most important of these thinkers was a French nobleman and philosopher named Baron de Montesquieu. In 1748, he published a landmark work called The Spirit of the Laws. In it, he argued that the safest way to protect the freedom of citizens was to ensure that the main functions of government were divided between separate and independent groups. If the same person who makes the laws is also the one who enforces them, and also the one who decides whether you broke them, then you have no protection at all. That person can make a law designed to harm you, enforce it against you, and then declare you guilty of breaking it. Montesquieu wrote very directly about this, saying that when the power to make laws and the power to carry them out are in the same hands, there can be no liberty. Montesquieu identified three distinct functions that every government performs. First, there is the job of making laws. Second, there is the job of carrying out or enforcing those laws. Third, there is the job of interpreting the laws, meaning deciding what a law actually means in specific situations and whether it was broken. He argued that these three functions must be given to three completely separate institutions, each independent from the others. This idea became the blueprint for one of the most influential constitutions in history. When the founders of the United States gathered in Philadelphia in 1787 to write their new constitution, Montesquieu's ideas were fresh in their minds. They had just finished a revolution against a king they felt had abused his power. The last thing they wanted was to create a new government that might do the same thing. James Madison, one of the key architects of the Constitution, wrote in the Federalist Papers, a collection of essays explaining and defending the new document, that the accumulation of all powers in the same hands is the very definition of tyranny. The Constitution they produced divided the government into three branches, each given a specific role, each placed in a separate article of the document. Let us look at each branch carefully. The first branch is the legislative branch, established in Article 1 of the Constitution. The word legislative comes from the Latin for lawmaking. The legislature is quite simply the part of the government that writes and passes laws. In the United States, this branch is called Congress, and it has two separate chambers, meaning two separate houses or groups. This two-chamber design is known as bicameral, from the Latin for two rooms. The lower chamber is called the House of Representatives, and it has 435 members whose numbers are proportional to the population of each state. A large state like California has many more representatives than a small state like Wyoming. The upper chamber is called the Senate, and each of the 50 states sends exactly 2 senators, regardless of size, giving smaller states equal voice in at least one half of Congress. For a law to pass, it must be approved by both chambers. This is already a significant barrier. It means that a law must survive debate and voting in 2 separate groups before it even moves forward. The powers given to Congress are substantial and specific. Congress controls the government's money. This is known as the power of the purse. No government department, no army, no federal agency can spend a single dollar unless Congress has first approved that spending. Think of how powerful this makes the legislature. Even if the president wants to do something, if Congress refuses to fund it, the idea dies. Congress also has the sole authority to formally declare war, though, as we will see later, this power has become complicated in practice. Congress regulates trade, both within the country and with foreign nations. And crucially, Congress has the power of impeachment. Impeachment is the formal process of accusing a senior government official, including the president, of serious wrongdoing. The House of Representatives brings the accusation, and the Senate holds the trial. A president who is impeached and convicted by the Senate is removed from office. The second branch is the executive branch, described in Article 2 of the Constitution. The word executive comes from the idea of executing, meaning carrying out or putting into action. If the legislature writes the laws, the executive's job is to make sure those laws actually happen in the real world. In the United States, the executive branch is headed by the president. Under the president are the vice president, the cabinet, which is a group of senior advisors who each head a major government department, and the enormous network of federal agencies and departments that do the day-to-day work of running the country. The Department of Education, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, these are all part of the executive branch. The president has several important powers. The president is the commander-in-chief of the military, meaning the president has ultimate authority over the armed forces. The president has the power to veto, which is a Latin word meaning I forbid. A veto is the president's ability to reject a law that Congress has passed, sending it back and preventing it from taking effect. This is a powerful tool. The president also makes nominations for senior government positions, including federal judges and ambassadors, and signs international treaties with other countries. The president can also issue executive orders, which are directives that have the force of law within the executive branch, allowing the president to manage how the government operates without needing a new law from Congress. And the president holds the power of pardon, meaning the president can forgive someone convicted of a federal crime and cancel their punishment. The third branch is the judicial branch, described in Article 3 of the Constitution. The word judicial relates to judges and courts. The judiciary's job is to interpret the law, meaning to examine specific situations and decide exactly what a law means, how it applies, and whether it is consistent with the Constitution. The judicial branch is headed by the Supreme Court, the highest court in the country. Below it are 2 levels of lower federal courts, district courts, where federal cases are first heard, and circuit courts of appeals, where decisions from district courts can be challenged. There are 9 justices on the Supreme Court, and they serve for life, or until they choose to retire. One of the most important things about the Supreme Court is a power called judicial review. Judicial review is the authority of the courts to look at a law passed by Congress or an action taken by the president and declare it unconstitutional, meaning it violates the Constitution and is therefore invalid. Remarkably, this enormous power is not actually written in the Constitution. It was established by the Supreme Court itself in a famous 1803 case called Marbury v. Madison. The Chief Justice at the time, John Marshall, argued in his ruling that it is the job of the courts, above all others, to say what the law is. If a law conflicts with the Constitution, and the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, then that law cannot stand. This ruling gave the judiciary a weapon of enormous consequence. Think of it this way. Congress might spend months passing a law. The president might sign it with great ceremony, and then the Supreme Court can examine it and, in effect, erase it. This brings us to the most dynamic and fascinating part of the whole system, the way these three branches interact with and restrain one another. Dividing the government into three parts is a good start, but the designers of the American system went further. They built into the Constitution a system of checks and balances. A check in this context means a tool one branch can use to limit or restrain another branch. A balance refers to the overall equilibrium that these checks are supposed to maintain. The idea is that no branch should be able to act entirely without the involvement or approval of at least one other branch. Let us trace how these checks work in practice. The president can veto laws from Congress, but Congress can override that veto if two-thirds of the members in both chambers vote to do so. This means that a president cannot simply kill any law they dislike, and a president's veto can be defeated if Congress feels strongly enough. The Senate must approve the president's nominations for judges and other senior officials. This means the president cannot simply place personal allies in powerful positions without scrutiny. Congress can impeach the president. The courts can strike down laws passed by Congress or orders issued by the president. And the president nominates the judges who sit on those courts, which means a president can shape the ideology of the judiciary over many years. Consider a real and vivid example of these dynamics at work. In 2010, the United States Congress passed a major law called the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. The law was designed to expand access to health insurance for millions of Americans who did not have it. Congress, which was controlled by the Democratic Party at the time, debated and passed the law through both chambers. President Barack Obama, a Democrat who had championed this policy throughout his campaign, signed the bill into law. This was the legislative and executive branches working together. But the story did not end there. Many states and organizations argued that parts of the law were unconstitutional. They took their challenge all the way to the Supreme Court. In 2012, in a case called National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius, the Supreme Court issued a complex ruling. It upheld the central part of the law, meaning the individual requirement to have insurance, but it struck down a provision that would have forced states to expand their Medicaid programs, ruling that this crossed a constitutional line. The judicial branch had reviewed the work of the legislative and executive branches and modified it. It did not throw the whole law out, but it drew a line. Then politics shifted. After the 2010 elections, Republicans took control of the House of Representatives. For the next several years, the Republican-controlled Congress voted dozens of times to repeal the Affordable Care Act entirely. But President Obama, using his veto power, blocked every attempt. Here was the executive checking the legislature. When Donald Trump became president in 2017, he used executive orders to change how parts of the law were implemented, weakening certain provisions without formally repealing the law, because repealing it required Congress and Congress could not fully agree. Here was the executive branch finding ways to act within the gaps of the legislative process. The entire saga of the Affordable Care Act is almost a textbook demonstration of all three branches interacting, conflicting, checking, and balancing one another over years. Now we need to think about some of the harder questions the system raises, because the separation of powers is not simply a neat diagram that works perfectly. It is a living system that creates genuine tensions and real problems. One significant concern that scholars and historians have written about is what they call the imperial presidency. This phrase does not mean the president has become an emperor, but it describes a pattern that emerged strongly in the 20th century where the executive branch has gradually expanded its power, particularly in matters of military action and national security. The Constitution says only Congress can declare war, but the United States has been involved in many significant military conflicts since the Second World War, including Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq, without a formal declaration of war from Congress, presidents argued they had authority as commander-in-chief to deploy forces. Congress passed the War Powers Resolution in 1973 to reassert its role, requiring the president to inform Congress within 48 hours of sending troops into conflict and limiting engagements to 60 days without congressional approval. But presidents of both parties have often found ways to work around this law, or simply argued it was unconstitutional. The result is a lasting tension about where executive military authority ends and congressional authority begins. Another deep and ongoing debate concerns the judiciary. Scholars and judges themselves are divided between two broad philosophies about how courts should interpret the law. Those who favor what is called judicial restraint believe that judges should be very cautious about striking down laws. Their argument is essentially democratic. The people elect Congress. Congress passes laws that reflect the will of the majority. Unelected judges, who serve for life and cannot be removed for their decisions, should not be substituting their own preferences for the expressed will of the people's elected representatives. The courts should only strike down a law if it is plainly and obviously unconstitutional. Those who favor what is called judicial activism take a different view. They argue that democracy is not simply about majority rule. History shows that majorities can oppress minorities. The whole point of a constitution is to protect rights and principles that cannot simply be voted away. Courts have a duty, in this view, to interpret the Constitution broadly and to protect individual freedoms even when the elected majority might prefer otherwise. The desegregation rulings of the 1950s, when the Supreme Court declared racial segregation in schools unconstitutional in the famous case Brown v. Board of Education, are often held up as a powerful example of judicial activism serving justice. Many states had laws supporting segregation. Those laws reflected local majority opinion. The court struck them down. Whether you call this activism or faithful constitutional interpretation often depends on whether you agree with a particular ruling. The tension between restraint and activism has no clean resolution. Every Supreme Court nominee in recent decades has faced intense questioning about their judicial philosophy, precisely because a single appointment can shift the balance of the court for a generation. This is one reason why the Senate's power to confirm or reject judicial nominees is so politically charged. When a president nominates a justice whose views are known, senators are not just evaluating that one person. They are trying to influence the direction of constitutional interpretation for the next 20 or 30 years. Perhaps the most visible challenge to the separation of powers in contemporary life is political polarization. Polarization means that the two major political parties have moved further apart in their views, with less middle ground and less willingness to cooperate. In the American system, it is entirely possible for the president to belong to one party while Congress is controlled by the other. This is called divided government. In theory, divided government is supposed to force compromise. One party cannot simply impose its wishes on the whole country. The branches must negotiate. But in practice, extreme polarization can turn this into gridlock, where nothing gets done at all because neither side will move toward the other. This raises a genuinely difficult question. Is gridlock a failure of the system, or is it the system working as intended? Some scholars argue that a system that makes it hard to pass laws is actually protecting liberty. If it is difficult to pass new laws, it is also difficult to pass bad laws, or laws that might remove freedoms or harm minorities. The high barriers to legislation mean that only measures with very broad support can succeed. Others argue that modern societies face real and urgent problems, from climate change to public health to economic inequality, and a system that produces paralysis is not serving its citizens well. There is no comfortable answer to this debate, which is itself a sign of how fundamental and contested the underlying question is. One more aspect deserves your attention. The separation of powers is not exclusively an American idea, but it has developed very differently in different countries. Many democratic nations use what is called a parliamentary system rather than the American presidential system. In a parliamentary system, such as that of the United Kingdom, Canada, or India, the executive branch actually comes from within the legislature. The Prime Minister is the leader of the party or coalition that holds the majority in Parliament. This means the executive and legislative branches are fused rather than separated. The Prime Minister must maintain the confidence of Parliament to stay in power. If Parliament votes against the government can fall. This creates a very different kind of accountability. In the American presidential system, the President and Congress are elected separately and cannot remove each other through ordinary votes, only through the exceptional process of impeachment. Each system has its advantages. Parliamentary systems tend to produce faster legislative action when a government has a strong majority. Presidential systems tend to produce stronger protection against any single party dominating all branches simultaneously. The judiciary in parliamentary systems also plays a different role. In the United Kingdom, for example, the concept of parliamentary sovereignty has historically meant that Parliament is supreme and no court can simply strike down an act of Parliament. This is fundamentally different from the American model where judicial review gives courts this enormous power. The United Kingdom has moved somewhat towards stronger judicial review through its Human Rights Act of 1998 and through its relationship with European courts. But the tradition remains different from the American approach. All of this brings us back to the central insight that Montesquieu offered and that the founders of the American Republic took so seriously. Power concentrated in a single place is dangerous. Spreading power between different institutions that can check each other creates friction, sometimes frustrating friction, but also creates protection. The system is not perfect. No human system is. Clever politicians find ways to exploit its gaps. Periods of crisis tempt governments to concentrate power in the name of speed and decisive action. Polarization can turn its deliberate slowness into complete dysfunction. But the core logic remains sound. A government where the same people make the rules, enforce them, and judge whether you have broken them gives you very little protection. A government where these functions are genuinely separated, and where each part can restrain the others, gives the citizens a fighting chance to hold power accountable. History offers us many examples of what happens when this separation breaks down. When Hitler became both head of government and head of state in Germany in 1934, merging the executive and legislative functions and subordinating the judiciary, the consequences were catastrophic. When courts in authoritarian states become simple instruments of the ruling party rather than independent interpreters of law, citizens lose the one place where they might challenge government action. The separation of powers is not just an abstract theory. It is a practical lesson learned from centuries of experience with what power does when it goes unchecked. As you think about this lesson, keep a few of the most important ideas in your mind. First, the separation of powers is the division of government into three distinct functions: making laws, carrying out laws, and interpreting laws. Second, these functions are given to three separate institutions: the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. Third, checks and balances give each branch tools to limit the other two, creating interdependence and mutual restraint. Fourth, the system is always evolving and always contested. The boundaries between branches shift over time, through political struggles, court rulings, and changing national circumstances. Fifth, the system involves genuine trade-offs. The same features that prevent tyranny can also produce gridlock. The same judicial independence that protects minority rights can also frustrate democratic majorities. And sixth, the system only works if the people within it and the citizens watching it take it seriously. Institutions do not protect themselves. They are protected by people who understand why they matter. To summarize what we have covered in this lesson, we began with the fundamental problem of power and how concentrated power can corrupt even well-intentioned people. We traced the idea of separated powers from Montesquieu's 1748 argument through to its expression in the United States Constitution. We examined each of the three branches in detail: the Congress, which makes laws and controls government spending, the President, who enforces laws and commands the military, and the courts, which interpret laws and can strike down those that violate the Constitution. We looked at the system of checks and balances that links these branches and creates mutual restraint. Using the story of the Affordable Care Act as a real example of all three branches interacting over time, we then explored the serious challenges and debates the system faces, the growth of executive power, the tension between judicial restraint and judicial activism, the paralyzing effects of political polarization, and the different approaches to separated powers in parliamentary systems like those of the United Kingdom. And we ended where we began, with the recognition that dividing power is one of humanity's most important political inventions, imperfect and contested, but deeply necessary.